Hey, Murderheads, I'm Tay, one of your hosts.
And I'm Nikki, your other host.
And together, we are Murder, She Taped. So,
I wanted to say it at the same time. But I didn't jump in.
You should have and just caught me completely
just
off guard. So, this is our very first released podcast. And so you're going to have to bear with us because talking about ourselves is really hard. But we want to give you some sort of information as to who we are and how we came to be Murder, She Taped. So, Nikki, I'm going to let you take the reins because you're way better at talking about yourself than I am.
I'm so good at talking about myself. Okay, so I think we'll just talk. I mean, people are going to get to know us over the podcast. So let's talk about like how we met. So I've been involved in the rescue circuit for 5 years, a little over 5 years now. You've been involved.
Like, I want to say three, four. I mean, I've fostered. I have never been in any way as big of a face as you have in rescue, obviously.
So I was looking for a photographer for one of my rescues was putting on a photo fundraiser for dogs. We do that a lot around here. And so I was looking for a photographer, searching. And one of our mutual friends said, Taylor, like, there's this opportunity. And she connected us. We started off rocky.
Nikki can be a bitch.
A little bit.
Off the hop. And I'm insecure, so...
Also... You're warm and fuzzy, and I'm like the old gothic grandma that doesn't really want anyone on her lawn. Does that make sense? Get off my lawn is how I feel a lot of time.
I've never figured out a description for you, and you just nailed it.
That is me. And you're just like so warm and fuzzy, and you want everyone to like you, and you're bubbly.
I'm the grandma on the lawn with cookies.
Yeah, you're like the cookie grandma, and I'm the gothic grandma.
But I hate kids, so.
Yeah, well, that's where we come in mutually, because I also hate kids. Anyways, back onto it. So we met that way. So yeah, we started off a little bit rocky, and then after the second photo fundraiser you did to me, we just really got along, and our dogs became best friends. We started drinking wine together. We got into personal stuff. I'd say, like, the last few months, maybe January-ish, we talked about true crime. I had mentioned to you about these podcasts that I've been listening to.
And I tried
to, like, touch on true crime. Like, I was... Because you gotta, like, dip your toe in. You can't just go full on, like, you wanna talk about murder? No. You gotta tip the way in there. You're like... Don't you want this podcast with me?
Really, it started out with, like, have you seen this Netflix documentary?
Yeah, that's true.
And we would talk about it. And then, yeah, in January, it was just kind of like, so there's these podcasts. You should listen to them. And then I became obsessed with some of them. And then...
I mean, shout out to Crime Junkies.
Really, great. Ashley Flowers is why I am doing what I'm doing.
So, yeah, we just kind of became, like... even closer, I guess, like on something that's such a taboo in our society of talking about true crime. And that's really how we started Murder, She Taped.
It is. And since then, we've been researching murders like crazy. We've been really working hard to get this podcast to be something more than just an idea. And I mean, our murder heads are going to have to bear with us as we figure out the kinks and all that fun stuff, but logo's coming out, our Instagram's up, make sure you toss us a follow in that regard, but yeah, it's really becoming something that we're excited about and we really want to bring somewhere.
So I think a little disclaimer to start off as well before we jump into your murder.
The gruesome tale of how I killed.
I think a huge part is we're not experts and we don't claim to be experts ever. We're the type of people that are going to sit around and watch documentaries, and then we want to talk about them. So we want to, like, watch Dateline, want to watch First 48 Hours. We want to watch that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we want to research the Canadian crimes because we're both Canadian. We grew up, you know, in Alberta. Huge for us. So I think that's one thing I just want to make very clear is I'm not an expert. If I get things wrong, if I say names wrong, I do apologize, and I know you do as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a total wee thing for sure.
Yeah, so that's huge for us. It's just don't expect us to be experts. We both work full-time jobs. This is like an extracurricular for us, and we're super excited to start it.
Yeah, so with that, we thought we would talk about a murder that, I mean, everybody knows about. This is the youngest case. I think the youngest murderer in Canada was in this case. And it is called the Murder in Medicine Hat, or the Richardson Murder.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, in 2003, Mark and Deborah Richardson, along with their two children, Jasmine, who was 10, and Jacob, who was 5, moved into Medicine Hat, Alberta. A nice family by all accounts. And they do have a photo of her here. We will post this photo on our Instagram. And before I get too carried away here, I also want to give a shout out to tapatalk.com and the user Patsy Stone. I'm actually just reading all the information that she provided here to, because she was able to explain it even better than I ever could. So thank you so much for the research that you did and the information that you were able to put out. But the photo that she posted of Jasmine Richardson, Jasmine's beautiful. She definitely does not look 10 in this photo. She looks older than me with full face on, like full face, full makeup is what I mean. Like, she looks easily like somebody I would hang out with at the bar.
Yeah. Like, I know, she's like an old, she looks really old compared to like what, but also at the same time, I think she also did that to seem older, to look older. I think that it was kind of a, she wanted to grow up too soon.
And what girl at 10 years old isn't trying to look older than what she is?
True, yes.
So Phyllis Gehring, who is their neighbor next door, actually made a comment that the family was quiet and were good neighbors. We knew them, but it wasn't like they came over or we went over there. We had no problem with them whatsoever, and I never heard a harsh word between the mother and father.
So the perfect fucking neighbors.
Really? They didn't bug you?
Yeah.
It was fine. And then came this case where Jasmine fell in love. I want to say that with quotations, because really, does she know what love is at that age? But in quotations, fell in love with this gentleman named Jeremy Allen Steinke, who was a self-described three-hundred-year-old werewolf, and who was actually, I think, he was said to be 21, 22? Do you remember?
He's 23. He was 23 in this case, yeah.
So he lived with his mother, Jacqueline May, and had no employment at that age. So Steinke and his family friend, Steinke's family friend, would say that Jeremy would start fights that he couldn't finish, often with older boys. He was a likable kid, but he could be manipulative, and his interest in underage girls was inappropriate. Mentally, I just think he was too young, which works because Jasmine thought she was too old, so it's like they met in the middle.
Yeah, but like a 300-year-old werewolf? Like, what was happening there?
He also wore a vial of blood around his neck, telling others that he liked the taste of blood.
That's not a werewolf, sir. That's a vampire. Who are you? You're not fucking Twilight. You gotta choose a side.
And he was a part of what? VampireFreaks.com?
I mean, I was on Vampire Freaks at one point, but I mean,
I've never heard of that.
What a weirdo. Before.
Yeah.
Fucking creep. Anyways.
Yeah.
That's just, it's just strange to me. He lived in such just this made up world.
He did. And Steinke's neighbor actually said, I used to live across the street from this creep, Jeremy. Jeremy's mother was interviewed saying how nice he was and how he could never do this, but I call bullshit. On numerous occasions, we saw a very high kid that would beat his mother, and he would push her and punch her and throw coffee tables at her. So he obviously had issues going on at home, for sure.
That's for sure, yeah.
In 2006, life in Medicine Hat for the Richardson family was good, until Jasmine turned 12. As part of her newfound preteen persona, she began styling herself as a goth, and then dating 23-year-old Jeremy Steinke, who professed his love to her and insisted to others that she was 14. So there's an issue with this age thing. People are paying attention to it. She's saying she's older than she is. Yeah. He is either lying to others about how old she is, or he believes that she's the age that she's saying.
Granted, her photo, though, that gothic photo, we will post it. She looks
at least 16.
I would say older than 16.
Like, I mean, with all that makeup and stuff, like, I don't blame him for, if he did believe that she was that age, I don't blame him for seeing her that way.
Yes, because she does look a lot older than what she is at 12 years old. It's actually fucking insane.
It is. And Jasmine's friends would also comment that she was a super nice girl at first, but then she changed when she started dating Jeremy. So things really seemed to start to go downhill. Mark and Deborah did not approve of the difference in age or the relationship, and promptly, made it clear to Jasmine and Jeremy that this was a no-go. Family friends said that they were furious about her relationship with Jeremy Steinke, and Jasmine had been grounded for a whole month. And somebody else also commented that when her parents found out about it, they took her phone away, her computer, and they forbid her from wearing makeup. So they grounded her to essentially keep them apart. And as a girl who's entering her teen stage, she's obviously identifying as an older chick. I mean, you take away her makeup, that's half her age gone.
Yeah.
You take away her phone, that's her communication to him gone. You take away her computer, and they were talking on Nexopia originally.
Yeah.
All of that's now taken from her. I mean, she must have been super frustrated. She's
fucking livid.
And as a young kid.
And plus she's like, she's 12. Like, she's just hitting that age where, like, she could possibly go in through puberty and all that stuff. Like, you're just adding fuel to the fire. Granted, I don't think the parents are wrong in this situation at all.
No, not.
Totally, they're totally right. But from her point of view, as a 12-year-old, I would have been fucking floored.
Well, her parents were standing in the way of spending time with him, and she resented their interference. I mean, Jasmine's friends commented that several times she said she wanted to kill her parents and move away to live with Steinke. They overheard Jasmine talking to Steinke on a phone, asking him to help her kill her parents, and she never used the word kill when talking about her parents, only that she wished that they would die. So there's a couple of different reports there. Yeah. No matter what, I don't think at that age she had the mentality to understand what she was saying, and I want to make that clear, because I'm sure people are going to assume, just like we did, if she's talking about killing her parents with her boyfriend, why is no one saying anything? And it's because who would take that seriously at that age? I mean,
I think as a 12-year-old too, like, you're sitting there thinking, I don't know how many times I've said, like, oh my God, my parents are the worst, I wish they'd die.
I feel like everybody says that.
Like, you're not sitting there being like, I'm going to plan my parents' murder, or you actually want them to die. You don't. It's just something that you say.
It is. And that's exactly it. None of Jasmine's friends took her threats to kill her parents seriously.
And I think also, like, hindsight's like 20/20 or whatever that quote is.
Mm-hmm. You nailed it.
Yes. Yeah. Also, you look back and you're like, well, she was trying to look older. She's goth. And then instantly when people hear goth, they think like fucking cults, like instantly, like just the devil, everything like that. And I don't know if that was like essentially her MO. Because, I mean, I was the kid at 12 years old that, like, yeah, like, I was kind of a weirdo and stuff, but I still wore, like, the candy necklaces and ate them and, like, you know, the big rings and, like, all that stuff. And, like, if you look back to me at 12 years old, like, I said the exact same things, but I just didn't look like a kid that maybe would have said them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In 2006, both Jeremy and Jasmine have sites on Nexopia, which was, I wasn't really old enough in this era to have Nexopia.
I was.
But I know a lot of people, especially around your age range, they did. Her username was Runaway Devil, and his was Soul Eater. And Steinke's personal profile refers to Jasmine's parents that, in quotations, it said, "Their throats I want to slit, especially when I see they are gone. Their blood should be payment." He posts other violent songs and poems referring to the Richardsons. An excerpt from his profile said, "I believe in blood, destruction, guts, gore, and greed. I'm the vocalist for my band called Project Status Quo. I also play guitar. My buddy Jordy is the pro on bass, and my cousin Grantis is on lead guitar. My bro Gary is the infamous drummer, and we're still in the midst of looking for another guitarist to add to the band." Jasmine's profile read, "Internet photos of herself in tight black clothing, sucking on her finger suggestively, falsely claiming she was 15, with her quote, in quotations, 'Welcome to my tragic end.'" They would have conversations often, and one of the conversations that they pulled up on her profile was, "I hate them, so I have this plan. It begins me killing them and ends with me living with you." And of course Jeremy replied, "I love your plan, but we need to get a little more creative with like details and stuff."
So this is where he's going in with it. Like, she's just, I feel like she's saying things like, you know, she wants them to die, blah, blah, blah. But he's the one that's, like, actioning it. Like, okay, like, that's a cool plan. Let's get into it.
Yeah, it's like she almost, I mean, they obviously were into poems and songwriting and more whimsical / dark shit. Mm-hmm. And to say it begins with me killing them and ends with me living with you is a pretty whimsical.
Yeah. I mean, I went through quote. The goth stage at like 14, and so, and I get, like, I mean, I used to write things that like didn't make any sense. Like, I just write things and like they would come off as like, that's so dark and twisted, but really, like, did I mean that? No,
of course not. You don't know what that means, right? Even at that age. So Jeremy Steinke tells his friends in person and via Nexopia that he's frustrated with Jasmine's parents. No shocker there.
No.
He and Jasmine talk about how much she hates her parents and possible ways of killing them, making it look like a murder-suicide or hitting them on the head while they sleep, and then burning the house down. The murder plans include the murder of her 8-year-old brother, Jacob, because, in quotations, he is too sensitive to be an orphan.
It's fucking twisted. So twisted.
A week before the murders, Jasmine sneaks out of the house and goes with Steinke back to his trailer. They have sex. 3 days before the murder, Jasmine tells a friend, in quotations, I'm going to kill my parents. The friend laughs off her comment. Jasmine responds, in quotations again, fine, don't believe me. 2006, April 19th, on Friday, Jacob had slept over at his friend's house next door. So tonight, Jacob's 5-year-old friend from next door joins the Richardsons for dinner. At 8, Jacob was only standing 4'4" and weighed 68 pounds.
Like, that's a small fucking kid.
Just a baby.
I mean, my basset hound, Rosie, is 70 pounds.
She weighs more.
She could fucking take him out.
She wouldn't.
She would. Rosie's a sweetheart. She's the best part of me. But you know what I mean? Like, that's insane to me.
I know. Even Milo. I mean, I have a little staffy and she's 70 pounds. Like,
yeah,
it's just weird. On April 20th, 2006, Soul Eater 52, Jeremy Steinke, on vampirefreaks.com, sends a message referring to, in quotations, doing morbid stuff to others, which I'm going to do this weekend. And then on April 23rd, Jeremy Steinke made 3 phone calls to Jordan Atfield, which is one of his friends. He's, in quotations, looking for help to scare Mark Richardson, Jasmine's father. So Jordan Atfield commented and said, that morning he told me we're doing it today. And I was like, what? You're doing what? And he's like, we're going to kill them. I didn't take him seriously. At 8 p.m., Jeremy Steinke arrives at Jordan Atfield's home to pick him up. Jordan wants no part of the trouble and says he won't go. Steinke slams the door and left.
Is there like a part of him that actually thinks that he is going to do it? Because all of a sudden he's just like, no, I don't want to go. Like, there must be a part of him that somewhat believes it.
Or maybe
he's just fed up with their friendship. Like, yeah. Maybe he's like, fuck this. Like,
he's just annoyed. It's too dramatic.
Yeah, like, everything that's happening in these two's lives are just so dramatic. He just wants something to do with it. Okay.
Could be.
I'll give him that.
10:45 p.m., Daniel Clark calls Jeremy Steinke and asks, what are you up to? Steinke responds, I'm watching a movie. I'll have to call you back when I'm done. Turns out the movie he was watching was Natural Born Killers. And there's actually comments that when he was watching Natural Born Killers and talking about this movie with his friends, he wanted to do the exact same thing to the Richardsons, except instead of letting the little boy live, like in that movie, he wanted to make sure the little boy died. Despite knowing that Steinke was plotting a murder and they tried to talk him out of it, no one notified the Richardsons of the danger, and no one notified the police, and no one notified their parents. And I just personally think it's because everyone was scared, and I don't think, again, they understood what was going to actually happen, because you're always in denial when it comes to things.
And I also think that, like, they threw the word murder and kill and all that stuff around so much. Like, plus, it was like, he hung out with young kids. Like, you don't want to be the kid that tells their mom or, like, tells the cops or, like, anything like that. And be all of a sudden like, well, I was just joking. I'm not actually going to do it. Damn, you're shunned.
Yeah, and I mean, they make comments. There are a lot of comments about him all the time saying that because he didn't fit in with the older group, he did fit in with the younger group. Yeah. And because of his age, he came off more as a leader to the younger people, I guess. And so to rebel against somebody that so many others looked up to, and I use that word so loosely, looked up to him, I just don't think that they really felt comfortable saying anything.
Yeah, I agree.
So Steinke arrived at the Richardson home in the dark. He is high on cocaine and he's drunk. He's dressed in a hoodie, all in black, with a ski mask. He's carrying a knife in his pocket, and he steps onto the dirt, leaving a footprint as he breaks into the house through the back window. Deborah Richardson hears a noise and comes down the stairs into the basement to investigate. She screams as she comes face to face with the masked intruder. Steinke stabs her 12 times, hitting her aorta and lungs. Blood sprays out into the stairwell leading to the basement. It splatters the floor, walls, and ceiling. Deborah dies at the bottom of the stairs, her body smeared with her own blood. Why did Deborah go down first?
Can we take a moment to be like, why didn't you send your husband?
I'm all for female empowerment, but
no. If I hear something in the basement, I'm just not going.
Lock the basement door, and I'm probably going to go stand out on the yard. Like, legit.
No, you're going to send Cody. Cody, go. Cody, go.
Yeah, because Cody's going to go.
Yeah.
Sure. At the sound of Deborah's screams, Mark Richardson and his son Jacob run from their bedrooms. Mark comes to his wife's aid, grabbing a screwdriver, and uses it to defend himself against the intruder's knife. He manages to temporarily choke Steinke and jammed a finger into one of his eyes. Ugh. During their struggle, Mark is stabbed 24 times, and there are countless slashes inflicted upon him. I just want to make a note here that during our research, we did come across some reports that Steinke had a really unstable upbringing. Yeah. And it was really because of the male role models in his life. The first husband would hit him with a belt. The second husband was hitting him with a paint stick.
Yeah.
The third husband would shove his head into a freezer. I mean, he had really bad experiences with men. And I just think that's why he literally doubled the stab wounds on Mark. And I think it's just because of all the anger he had to male authority.
I mean, granted, he's a bigger guy, yes. But I definitely agree. Like, I think that he took care of the
male,
the dad. Yeah,
he did. He really did handle it. And that makes me so nervous. Like, it's just such chill. It's so chilling, you know, that an upbringing could have this much of an impact on how he looks at people. Because I don't think he really saw Mark as an individual. He just saw him as another guy who could potentially be doing the same thing to Jasmine that he got from his parents.
Well, and he's pushing him away too.
Exactly.
It's another male figure that's pushing him out of a family that obviously wants to be a part of. Like, it's totally. Her family. He's in love with her. Another person, male figure that's just pushing him away.
Exactly. And I mean, during their struggle, like I said, Mark was stabbed 24 times. There was so much blood that came from Mark that he actually had no blood left by the time emergency services were there, and he had no blood. His blood was all over the futon, the gas fireplace, the exercise equipment, the banister, the ceilings, and the walls. It was all over Steinke and the screwdriver. I mean, I just want to be very clear here that there was no attempt to even clean anything up. It was left very messy, kind of scrambled. Yeah. And when Mark was dying, his final words were, in quotations, why? And Steinke said, because your daughter wanted it that way. The attack is so violent. The filleting knife Steinke used is bent and buckled in the middle and curved the tip almost like a hook. He also dropped that next to Mark's body, leaving him. And then, walking up the stairs, he left bloody handprints on the walls. Jacob Richardson, having awoken to his mother's screams, is frightened, and he was standing in the hallway in his underwear near his bedroom, where he hears his father struggling with the intruder. Then he sees the masked intruder coming up the stairs, and his sister holding a black-handled kitchen knife. She stands over him as he begs, "I'm scared, I'm too young to die," and she mercilessly stabs him. As he flees to his bedroom, 100 precious drops of blood drop onto the carpet. The murdering pair follow him. One of them tried to strangle him, causing pinpoint bleeding inside his eyelids and mouth. Jasmine stabbed him 3 more times in his face and chest, and then she slashed his throat, severing his jugular vein, causing his blood to soak into his bedding and then spray throughout his room. Ugh. Steinke watches as Jasmine murders her brother while his shoelace soaks up some of the 8-year-old's blood. According to Jasmine's testimony and evidence found during the investigation, she had called Jeremy and told him that she wanted to kill her parents because they were being mean to her, but she was only joking. And then that night, when she woke up and heard Jeremy breaking into the house, her mother went downstairs and screamed, and then her dad did, and then Jacob came out of the bedrooms. She could hear her dad and Jeremy fighting downstairs, and she raced back upstairs and grabbed a knife that she had hidden in her closet in case she needed to protect herself. Jeremy came up the stairs, staggering, covered in blood, and screaming at her to kill her brother. He yelled, "Stab him, just stab him," slit his throat, and when she replied, "I can't, I can't," he said, "You have to. I did this for you."
The thing is, like, if she didn't know it was, like, gonna happen, and you hear your mom downstairs screaming,
I'd be calling the cops.
What are you doing? Like, run. He's your fucking boyfriend. Like, run down there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, maybe she just
was scared.
She's scared. She's 12, and I have to remember that. But, like, deuce, you did nothing.
Mm-hmm. Jacob said that he was scared and that he was too young to die, and then she said she only stabbed him once somewhere in his upper body because she couldn't do anymore, and then Jeremy grabbed the kitchen knife and slit Jacob's throat. I couldn't look, but I heard him struggling to breathe. He was gurgling. I didn't do anything to stop him. I was like a zombie. I could barely function. It didn't even enter my mind to call 911. So the aftermath of the event, Jasmine checks out her boyfriend's handiwork, goes downstairs, see her mother and father lying in pools of their own blood. Steinke left Jasmine's Steinke left Jasmine at the house amid the gore and went home. Mark's brand new white truck was sitting in the driveway and undergoes a smashed passenger window. When he gets home to his trailer, he touches the doorknob on his room, leaving traces of blood. Not cleaning up himself.
No, like, he's not.
They're not thinking
at all.
Jasmine rinsed off the kitchen knife in the upstairs bathroom, but really all she did was dilute Jacob's blood on the blade, and then she set it on the vanity, and it dripped pink blood.
Yeah.
The house was quiet. The doorknobs, carpet, and light switches were covered in blood.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine, like, being there? Again.
In that
house? You're left alone. Call the fucking cops. He left you there.
He did. After the butchery, Jasmine just cleaned herself up, packed up her clothing, stole her mother Deborah's bank card, walked to the bank machine, took out some cash, called a taxi, and went to Steinke's trailer. Which makes me really think that she does play more of a role in this than she's ever willing to let on.
I mean,
at the end of the day, a lot, from what we've seen, she always does initiate the conversation. She didn't do anything about it when the situation was happening. She didn't do anything about it after, when she was left by herself.
Yeah.
So some hours later, the murdering twosome are at a friend's apartment where a party is occurring. Jasmine and Steinke are seen kissing, giggling during and throughout the entire party, and they discuss the murders and the cleanup. Steinke laughed while describing the killings. He shared their plans for a gothic wedding that would end with them living in a German castle. Later, they had sex.
Ugh, my God.
Friends were making comments about it, and, I mean, one friend said he showed us his wounded eye and said he'd kill Jasmine's parents and that he gutted them like a fish, and also, you know, that Jasmine had killed her brother and he was proud of her and
bragging. Bragger's son.
And then Jasmine said, "I loved him so much. I thought it would bring us closer together." Just a mess. So two of their friends wipe down the seats in Steinke's truck, getting rid of the bloody splotches. Afterwards, they park it out of sight. A friend of Jacob's was actually the one to discover the body, and his mom, Sarah Penner, at first thought he was full of shit. She was like, "I told my son he better not be lying when he raced home to tell me that there was something going on next door."
It's a mom thing to say.
It is.
"You better not, you're full of shit. You better not be fucking lying."
So her and her son actually went back to the home, looked through the windows, and then, scared that the killer was still around, went back into their minivan and then called 911. So Sergeant Dave Townsend, who was a part of the Medicine Hat Police, said a caller did observe a body within the residence and called us, and that's how we were dispatched and made aware of the scene. So, again, Jasmine did nothing to alert authorities.
Nothing. Not a single thing.
So, a new white truck sits in the driveway of the house, and the passenger window is smashed out. This, we know, was Steinke. The house is silent. Four police officers break down the front door. Constable Ian Scribner is one of those officers. Inside, they discover walls smeared with bloody handprints, and downstairs, there's Mark and Deborah, who are deceased. The officers find 8-year-old Jacob upstairs. His bed is soaked in blood and his throat is slashed open. While searching throughout the house, the officers become concerned. There's a child missing. There's a portrait of a family of four. The Richardson's daughter isn't among the dead. So police fear that Jasmine is also a murder victim. So they release help to the media to locate this missing girl.
Which is why we can find photos of her.
Exactly. Sergeant Townsend commented, "She may or may not be related to the homicide. However, we're trying to ensure that she's safe." The crime scene investigators process the home, and a crowd has gathered in the neighborhood. Officers and forensic personnel are stunned and horrified at the carnage. At 4:38 p.m., the Richardson bodies are removed from the house. Jeremy, Jasmine, and Casey Lancaster, and three other girls begin driving towards Leader Saskatchewan Stanky's truck. The triple murders are front page news, and the group passes around the paper. The paper features Jasmine's school photograph. One of the underage girls commented that she was smiling about it, and they were pointing things out in it. So again, Casey, Jasmine, and Jeremy know full on what's going on, but these three girls that are there have no idea. Investigators search Jasmine Richardson's school locker, and they find a crudely drawn picture that she has made of lighting her family on fire and running to Jeremy's truck. Then they begin interviewing her friends. April 25th, 2006, Leader RCMP Constable Aaron Ewert was actually the one who found Jeremy and Jasmine in the pickup truck. So he saw that this truck had been parked at a school. He was originally parked at a gas station trying to see if they'd come around. Regardless, they were caught, and Jeremy was charged with 3 first-degree murders. Jasmine was charged with 3 first-degree murders. And Stanky's friend Casey Lancaster, who was actually said to have had a crush on Jeremy at that age, but he picked Jasmine, and so she was always a little bit jealous, and so I'm assuming that's probably why she was so willing to help. Was because she was like, oh, he needs help in this dire need.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump right in.
So she was an accessory for disposing of evidence. Shortly after their arrest, Stanky asked Richardson to marry him. She, of course, said yes. May 2006, the funeral of Mark, Deborah, and Jacob was held at a church in Sudbury. 2 sheriffs overhear Stanky telling a fellow prisoner, "I did my girlfriend's mother and father, and she did her brother. I was stabbed in the eye with a screwdriver." So things are growing, and he's bragging, and he's still really satisfied with what happened. So police are catching on to this, and they send an undercover officer, Corey Both, posing as a prisoner to hear a little bit more. So this is what Jeremy said. "You hear about that triple homicide? Yeah, you're looking at him. Me and my old lady have become legends. It was all me and my girlfriend. We just started our own legacy. I tried to talk her out of it, and she was so upset. I don't like that. I'm a man of my word. So I said, let's do it. I know I'm pretty twisted, but I didn't think I would be that twisted. I never thought that I'd actually kill anybody, but when I found my soulmate, my true love, I just for some reason was willing to do anything for her. I never thought I'd go to jail, and then I met her and told her I'd do anything for her, and now I'm paying the consequences. I was drinking a 2-4 of beer, a bottle of Vampire brand red wine, and did a gram of blow at a coke dealer's friend's house. I was like a rocket flying high as a kite. I've got some mental problems, though. I was definitely not in the right state of mind. I snuck into the house through a basement window while the family was asleep. I remember standing there in her basement expecting her dad to come downstairs. Instead, it was her mom." Which again, we were all expecting.
We're expecting the dad.
"He came at me real fast. I thought I was going down. He grabbed my face and shoved his thumbs in my eyes. My old lady's father is a big guy. When he came at me with a screwdriver, I was scared shitless. I screamed. I just stabbed him. I'm surprised I came out on top. I thought I was a dead man. The father's dying words was, 'Why?' And I replied, 'Because your daughter wanted it that way.' I went upstairs and watched my girlfriend cut her brother's throat. It didn't bother her at all either. She didn't cry or anything. In fact, the next day we were on the road fucking, and she was laughing about it. She's got a few screws loose, too. It was torture being apart from her. Me and my girlfriend got pretty fucked, and we have a pretty fucked up relationship. So when we're going at it, or whatever, you know, fucking, getting all intense and shit, she'll, like, claw my back to the point where I'm bleeding, and she'll bite my neck and actually, like, pierce the skin and start drinking my blood. Fucking, I don't know, man. That's something I kind of miss. Me and my girlfriend are freaks, man. She's 13 going on 14. She's legal age. I gave a vial of my blood to her. We exchanged vows through prison love letters. I never got a chance to buy her an engagement ring. We'll get wedding ring tattoos on our ring fingers. I want a gothic wedding. I treat my girlfriend like a fucking queen. I'm going to save up money, and we're going to buy one of those little castles in Germany with 100 rooms. I'm a ladies' man. You know what they want, and you give it to them. She's going to be there for me when I get released, and I'm putting all my faith into her. I'm worshipping her more than I worshipped anything.
That is right intense. And he's like, he doesn't even realize that, like...
He's saying and who he's talking to and how he's saying it.
Like, you should know better.
So, during the court trials, prosecutor commented that Jasmine was the motive and Stanky was the means. So, it falls right in line with what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Jasmine came up with the idea and the reasoning to do it. And Stanky had the physical follow-through.
Mm-hmm.
And... was more than
he took it to
happy.
The next level.
Yeah. Was more than happy to help out in any way that he could.
Yeah.
Officers, forensic specialists, friends, family, neighbors, everyone testified against the murderous pair. So Stanky blamed his participation in the murders on his upbringing, which, again, we've kind of briefly talked about. Yeah. He did have an unstable upbringing. He has mental issues. He had ADHD, and he had depression, and Lord knows what else he had going on. Tim Foster, who was an attorney for Richardson, said, although she talked about it, and although she said all those things, she never ever meant it. In order to find her guilty, you have to find that intent. You have to find that she intended for Jeremy to kill her family. They didn't have a destination in mind to run away to. She hadn't packed a bag. He left her at her family's home after the slayings. That proves there wasn't any foresight on her part that would have suggested she orchestrated these killings. I never really picked up on packed a bag.
I know, neither did I.
It's a valid point.
But also just going back to, like, he saying it's his upbringing. Like, there's people that have had worse lives than he have that don't fucking murder a family.
There are people who survived the Holocaust and didn't spend the rest of their lives killing people.
Yeah, like, that's where... And I get where they're saying, you know, she didn't have the foresight of what was going to happen. She also didn't do anything to stop it.
No.
Which upsets me.
Well, so Stephanie Cleary, who is a Crown prosecutor, replied, her testimony is unbelievable. Her explanation of being in a trance-like state or zombie-like state, as we heard, can't be trusted. You can't rely on it. It cannot raise reasonable doubt in your mind about her guilt. The reason her tale doesn't make sense is not because she's 12 and not because she was involved with Jeremy, but because it's not true. She was not a zombie that night, but was thinking clearly and following a plan. After the killings, she packed some clothes, stole her mother's bank card, went to a nearby convenience store, took out money from the bank machine, hailed a taxi, went to Stanky's trailer.
She did all that stuff.
Hours later, she and Stanky had sex at a friend's apartment and were seen cuddling at a party. At no time did she call the police, seek help, or check on her family to see if they were still alive.
Yeah, that is very true.
In cross-examination, Cleary also commented, you had plenty of opportunities to get help or to stop your boyfriend, and if there wasn't a plan, you would have begged him. Richardson replied, there was no plan. Then Judge Scott Brooker said, even if Stanky physically stabbed the girl's mother, her father, and brother, under Canadian law, an accused can be found guilty if they intentionally help, encourage, or persuade another person to commit a crime. To find the accused guilty of first-degree murder, they must agree that the Crown proved there was planning and deliberation involved. When testifying during his trial, Jeremy Stanky denied exchanging any words with Mark Richardson during the struggle of Mark's life, even though he already released cop. Family victim impact statements, and I'm only going to read a couple of these, but Peter commented, which was, he was Deborah's brother, said, I will never understand why she was taken, and I will never understand the workings of sick and twisted minds, but I do understand about forgiveness. She taught me that. So it is for her sake and through the deep love for my sister who is watching over us right now that I extend forgiveness. Mark Richardson's stepmother said, I relived that fight that the parents put up to protect their kids and the terror of Jacob when he realized his big sister would not help him. And that sat with me.
Yeah, that hits home.
So, during sentencing, Judge Kent said, I'm about to send you away to jail for a very long time. And this is to Stanky. perhaps for the rest of your life, and it's because of the horrific, unspeakable violence you've committed against the victims. Maybe sometime in the future, you can begin to repay all the damage that you've caused. Do you have anything to say before you're sentenced? Steinke keeps his head bowed and shook his head no. Elaine Heppner, who is a defense attorney, said, "He told me before I came into court, and these are his words, that if he could take it all back, he would." On July 9th, 2007, Jasmine Richardson is found guilty on all three accounts of first-degree murder. Due to her age, she is sentenced to the maximum penalty, 10 years imprisonment. The sentence includes credit for 18 months in custody to be followed by 4 years in an Edmonton psychiatric facility and 4.5 years under conditional supervision within the community. December 15, 2008, Jeremy Allen Steinke is found guilty on all three counts of his first-degree murder, sentenced to 3 life sentences to be served concurrently. He will be eligible for parole after serving 25 years, starting from the time he was placed in custody. And a sample of Steinke's DNA is to be ordered and sent to the National Databank, and the judge issues a lifetime ban from owning weapons. At Steinke's trial, several of his young female hangers, or crew, posse, other girls he's manipulated, commented, "I would have started crying if he looked at me. He gave me a hug and said, 'See you later,' so I'm going to hold him to the 'see you later' part." Under cross-examination, all of their friends said they'd never taken any of the friends' threats of murder seriously. And that is the Richardson murder case. I mean,
that's such a fucked up murder.
She's released. She's
just living a life.
Doing something. I tried to find any details more about like her and her like family upbringing. Or even like about her parents a little bit more, and I couldn't find a whole lot of details. But I mean, this is one that I heard about back in September, and I just find it crazy. I find it crazy that there was justice served, but it didn't make up for the fact that the mom and the dad were fighting to save their kids' lives. They were murdered.
Well, because they did nothing wrong. At the end of the day, they did nothing. They parented the way that
Any parent would.
I mean, I look at my parents, like Mike and Debbie, like, if I was dating someone at that age, they would have lost their minds too. Easy.
I mean, I had a friend who was 16 dating a 23-year-old, and my mom was like, "There's no way I would ever allow you to date somebody that age."
I mean, I think any time under the age of 18, when you're dating someone that much older, it's just not
appropriate.
It's not.
You're not at the same life stage.
No.
Not in the slightest.
Like, I mean, if I dated someone now, and I have dated people that are way older than me,
mm-hmm.
we still don't have a lot in common, but it works. Like, we still, you know, you make it work because I'm at the point of my life where I own a house, I work full time, whatever. I might not get their jokes from the fucking, like,
50s.
80s. The 50s. What's that 50s reference? But you know what I mean? Like, it's just, I can't imagine, like, what they really had in common.
No one at that age has a whole bunch in common other than the fact that they were both misfits. I mean, they didn't fit in. They were both, I mean, it was like a Romeo and Juliet thing. This is forbidden, and that's what makes it that much more enticing. Mm-hmm. So I just think that it was kind of like a perfect storm in the fact that...
Well, he's immature, too.
He was immature. He fit her maturity level that was mature for her age.
Yeah.
She didn't fit in with her group. He never fit in with people his age. Romeo and Juliet, parents aren't allowing them to be together, mm-hmm. forbidden love, blah, blah, blah. And they took that and they ran. And it just got to a point. Well,
it's fucking like fire and gasoline together.
It was. Obvious. They just got to a point that you couldn't go back.
Yeah.
And now she has to live. And not have
she has to try and have a normal life now, and she has no family. And I think at the age of, like, now that she is at the age that she is, could you imagine, like, realizing that you're the reason that you don't have a family anymore, and you're not dating that guy anymore? You, like, he's in jail and you're trying to live a normal life, and that's what's so fucking sad about it.
It's, and like you said, it's, she didn't know any, like, it's not that she didn't know better. I mean, I know she made, I'm not making excuses for her.
She made error and error, like, errors upon errors.
I don't think, she obviously wasn't at the mental capacity, and clearly she went to a psychiatric facility.
Which is good,
I think. There was something underlying more so in her brain that didn't allow her to understand the ramifications of what she was about to do. So now that she's gone and seeked a psychiatrist, and she's probably on medication to help her, and she's probably gone to therapy, now she's understands, but it's too late.
It's too late. That's the problem, is it's too late.
I mean, I wish I had a moral of the story here. I mean, don't tell your kids to not date people. But I can't. So I just think that cases like this are important, because when your friends are isolating themselves and talking about doing some things that maybe they might be joking and you might not want to take them seriously, talk to somebody about it.
Yes.
Mention it to someone, mention it to a friend. If you're, I mean, if you're younger, mention it to a parent or something. Because if anyone had ever said anything to police or even to the Richardsons,
they may have been able to stop it.
There might have been some sort of thing that they could have used to deter it.
Yeah, like a different outcome.
So we're going to be posting the pictures on our Instagram. And Nikki, do you want to share with the users what our Instagram user is?
It's at MurderSheTaped.
Perfect. Super easy.
Easy.
It's super easy to follow us. We'll post the pictures to give you guys a little bit more of a reference, put a face to a couple of the names that we can. If you guys have any questions regarding this podcast and our very first one, we encourage you to reach out to us. We do have an email. You can contact us through there. It's on our Instagram bio.
Yeah, we'll also, murdershetaped@gmail.com.
And we'll also be posting that on our YouTube channel as well. Yeah. If you love it, toss us a follow. Tell your friends to toss us a follow. We'd appreciate any sort of support. Hopefully, we're not the only ones who are going to be listening to ourselves.
I hope we have, like, some murder heads interested. Come on. Stay with us.
We're going to have such cool cases coming up. All of it's going to be Canada-based. So if you're a Canadian citizen, this is a really great opportunity to learn more about cases that happened in your backyard.
Also, if you find, like, you know, you're interested in a case and you're like, shoot us an email and just say, hey, have you heard about this case? And maybe we'll share it on the show.
Yeah, and we'll definitely give you a shout out. And thank you for your contribution to helping us with this podcast. We're really excited to see where it goes from here. And we thank you for listening.
Thanks, Murderheads.
Bye.